The Minnesota quarterback leader. You can't hear me?
Hello? Okay. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Ross, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals. We are hearing three matters today, all three remotely, as we are this first matter. And other than appearing remotely, and I see two attorneys, so it looks like we, along with two other judges and myself, so we should have a full house. If at any time during the proceeding you're having difficulty with your technology or hearing us or hearing each other, you may have to give us some signals, and the host is always available as well, and she'll assist if we need to. And I think you have phone numbers in case of emergency if you need to connect by phone if that's necessary. So far, we've had fairly good luck, I would say, with relative minor issues overall. And so we appreciate your patience in that regard. You'll notice the clock. That's the marshal who introduced introduced us. And he will be operating that in the normal fashion. And so, of course, keep your eye on that. So other than appearing remotely, everything else should be relatively what you're used to. Appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent 15 minutes. And then, of course, appellant 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose. We do ask that you introduce yourself as typical when you begin your argument, because we are recording these proceedings, which are available on the court's website per usual. And so I'll just introduce the first case, our file number A19-1334, State of Minnesota versus Jeffrey Allen Kuralchuk. And counsel for appellant, as soon as you are ready, you may proceed.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Just for clarification, do you prefer us to stand during argument, or is it permissible?
No, we're used to individual sitting, although we've had a little bit of both. I think the main thing, as long as you can see us and we can see you, that's the important
okay
point. And along with hearing, of course.
And for the record, we can only see you from the waist up, so you may be standing, as far as we know.
it's a good point, Judge Ross. Okay, that makes sense. Sounds good. Okay. May it please the court. Should I begin, Judge Slater?
Okay. Yes, you may begin. Thank you.
Okay. May it please the court. My name is Michael McLaughlin. I'm an attorney from the State Public Defender's Office. Today, I'm representing the appellant, Jeffrey Kuralchuk, on this appeal. The central question here is for a massage therapist to be guilty under a fourth degree sexual assault under 609.345, subdivision 10, for having non-consensual sexual contact with a client, must that therapist subjectively have intended to engage in non-consensual sexual contact? The parties disagree on that issue. It's our position that the statutory language and decisions in Dorn and other controlling authority require the defendant to intend to engage in that prohibited conduct of non-consensual sexual contact.
I have a question for you that sort of transcends that legal question, and it's a factual one.
Sure.
As I read your brief, I see you stating as a matter of fact that in this case, your client asked the question inquiring whether he should go lower with his hands.
Right.
And the accuser responded by nodding her head affirmatively. You state those as a matter of fact, but didn't she testify that he suddenly put his hands on her breasts, and didn't she testify that she was surprised by it, and she didn't testify to any inquiry, and she didn't testify to nodding her head? And doesn't the jury's verdict indicate that the jury believed her version and not the one that you're presenting in your brief?
It's to deal with, in response to the first aspect of that question, you're correct. Sure, her testimony was that she gave no indication of consent prior to when he touched her breasts. There was a statement after he touched her breasts that she testified to as well, that he asked her if she wanted to finish, and she said yes, and then he engaged in further sexual contact after that. It's our position that the conduct that occurred after the touching of the breasts is still relevant to his state of mind at the time he touched the breasts.
Well, didn't the sexual contact already occur at the time he touched her breast?
Yes, but what the actions that happened after are relevant to what his state of mind was at that earlier time. In our case,
going back to my question, though,
yep.
the facts, as you assert them in your brief, are not the facts that we have to assume are true for the purposes of our review. Am I correct about that? That we have to assume that the jury disbelieved your client when your client said that he asked about where his hands were, where his hand could go, and whether she affirmatively responded?
The argument that we attempted to make in the legal sufficiency section is that even accepting her testimony as true.
Well, hold on one second. Yep. I just want to get a clear answer to the question.
Yep.
Am I correct that when we consider the circumstances proved, we consider the circumstances yes. based upon the verdict? And in this case, that means what was proved was that your client did not ask and she did not affirmatively assent with the nodding of the head. Isn't that the way we have to consider this on appeal?
Yes, we have to accept her testimony as true on appeal. And the argument we make is her testimony alone, her testimony that he asked for permission midway through the sexual contact, her testimony that that he suggested that she schedule a longer appointment next time, her testimony that she gave him a tip, and also her testimony that she characterized his conduct as an attempted happy ending massage in a text message shortly after. All of those statements in her testimony are consistent with a reasonable inference that he was mistaken. Not that she affirmatively gave consent, but that his subjective state of mind was that he had permission. And it's our permission that, or it's our position that if this court believes that the statute requires the defendant to have that subjective state of mind to actually intend.
Then let me pause for a moment. Let's not talk about the touching around her vagina. Am I correct that the touching of her breasts, if it was non-consensual, would support the verdict?
Yes, it would.
Okay, yes. So let's talk about what it is in the facts that would give your client any reason to believe that she had consented before he touched her breasts. What did she say or do to suggest consent?
I mean, our argument isn't that she did anything objectively to establish consent. Our position is that he was genuinely mistaken that he had such consent.
Right. The question I have is, on what factual basis would anyone reasonably believe he had consent to touch the breasts, the bare breasts, of a massage client at the time that he did so? What is it that she did or said before then that would have given him any reason to believe that she consented?
There's nothing in her testimony that establishes a reasonable belief that she consented. We acknowledge that, but we also,
I guess, isn't that the whole package?
No, if your
client didn't consent,
yeah,
for the first touching, and the jury demonstrated that overall she didn't consent, otherwise it wouldn't have issued a guilty verdict. I don't understand why that doesn't end the whole question for us.
Because our position is that he needs to intend it to be non-consensual. It's not enough that there was no reasonable evidence of consent. He needs to intend his act to be a non-consensual act.
Well, that's my point. If it's not, if you've agreed that there's nothing from which a reasonable person would have thought this woman is consenting to me touching her breast. There's nothing in the facts, as we accept the circumstances proved, that would lead a reasonable person to that belief. So right. what are you suggesting then? I don't understand your argument.
We're suggesting that it's a subjective test. It's not a reasonableness test. It's not an objective test. It's a subjective test. And what matters is, did the defendant subjectively in his own head think she wanted the contact?
I see. So your argument would be, if you had a sexual psychopath raping a woman who is screaming, no, 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 no. And that person subjectively infers that means yes, that you have to prove what's going on in his head in order to get a conviction for a crim sex.
Again, it's unique to this massage subdivision. It's the only subdivision that states as what constitutes the crime that it needs to be non-consensual sexual contact. That's the behavior that makes the conduct criminal under.
Okay, well, let's talk about it in the context of massage. What if he groped her breasts after she said, I do not want you to touch my breasts. You do not have permission to touch me anywhere other than my shoulders. It's your position that if your client believed in his mind that no meant yes, and the state didn't disprove that because of some unique psychological characteristic in your client, that your client is not guilty under the statute. Is that your argument?
Well, I think under the facts you presented, the state would be able to prove it wasn't his subjective intent. I mean, the jury is always going to make a credibility determination of whether or not the defendant subjectively intended something. I mean, for any, you know, it's other crimes have a requirement of a subjective requirement.
But your position is the state would still have to prove it. In that circumstance, if the defendant said, no, let me give you a list of character. Let me tell you my psychological background. I grew up to learn that no meant yes. I heard a country song once that said no meant yes. I was convinced this was the case. Your view is that the state can't convict unless what?
Well, I think in that scenario, the state would convict because it wouldn't be a credible defense, it wouldn't be a credible statement that's what he subjectively believed. But here, the case is different. There were things outside of his own statements of intent that corroborated an explanation that he was operating under some sort of mistake.
Mr. McLaughlin, I have a similar question. So you're talking about how it needs to be based on his subjective intent, what he intended. But doesn't the circumstantial evidence standard provide for that? Because intent is very difficult to prove by direct evidence. So it has to be proved by, more often than not, by circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
What did he subjectively mean in his mind? And so we employ a two-part test. We first look at the circumstances proved, and then second, we look at what reasonable inferences are there, including of guilt and of if there's a reasonable inference of not being guilty. But don't we look at the circumstantial evidence to determine whether or not he intended to engage in consensual or non-consensual sexual contact?
Yes. Yeah. So we look at the objective circumstances and from that infer what his intent was. And that's the way this court has said intent is most often proven, through circumstantial evidence based on the objective circumstances.
Okay. So based on that, going back to Judge Ross's questions, why isn't the fact that, and I think you've acknowledged that there's nothing in her testimony indicating that she consented to the touching of her breasts, why isn't that enough right there to establish that he engaged in non-consensual sexual contact when he touched her breasts?
Well, the evidence about her, the lack of evidence that she gave affirmative consent prior to the touching the breasts, that issue goes towards the question of objective consent in our view, but it's a separate question whether or not he believed in his mind that he had such permission.
Right, but you acknowledge that we look at the circumstantial evidence mm-hmm. to determine whether or not somebody had the intent. So based on the circumstances proved here, isn't that enough to show or and to support the jury's verdict that they believed he did indeed have the intent to engage in non-consensual sexual conduct based on the circumstances proved up to that point of not her not providing any indication that she wanted him to touch her breasts?
It doesn't show that the jury made that determination, because what the jury was presented with was the question of, did she provide affirmative consent? Did she objectively manifest a consent to his conduct? And that's a different question than whether he believes subjectively that he was acting against her consent. And
going to Judge Reyes's question, I guess, Mike, we have to take the circumstances as they're given to us. In order for your legal issue even to be a concern, a material, doesn't there have to be some reason in the record from which a jury could infer that your client believed that he had consent?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we'd agree with that. And we feel like there are those subjective circumstances among the circumstances that the state offered part of this proof. Him asking for permission to continue sexual contact before he proceeded to touch her vagina area, that supports a reasonable inference that he believed he was operating under permission at that point, and that's why he sought further permission to continue on with the sexual contact. The second circumstance is his suggestion after the massage that she schedule a longer session next time. Again, if he believed that he was acting against her consent, that's inconsistent with him suggesting that she come back for a longer massage next time. And then her statement to a friend shortly after the massage that described it as he attempted a happy ending massage.
Wait a minute. What does her statement to her friend acknowledge that he had at the time that he engaged in the conduct?
It's more attenuated. I agree it's more attenuated. I mean, his conduct's the most relevant to his intent. But
well, when you say most relevant, I'm suggesting to you her comments are irrelevant. Why aren't her comments irrelevant to what was going on in his head?
Her comments bear on the circumstances, whether the circumstances could have led him to have that subjective belief. I mean, if she thought he was acting like he thought he had permission, that's consistent.
By the way, one of her text comments suggested that what he did was illegal.
Yes, her second, and that's true. I mean, it's again.
How does that fit into your idea that her conversation afterwards suggested that it was consensual when she communicated her belief that his conduct was illegal?
I mean, I think both comments have to be put side by side. And again, the test for sufficiency is just that her statements support a reasonable inference inconsistent with guilt. And at least her initial statements do support such that reasonable inference. They're not as strong as the evidence, which is where the primary evidence that's inconsistent with guilt is his behavior throughout the massage and after the massage, that he asked for permission and then he behaved after the massage as if she consented to the conduct and wanted to come back for another session and that she should come back for a longer session. Again, he wouldn't engage in that behavior, or at least it's a reasonable view that he wouldn't engage in that behavior unless he thought that he was acting under her permission.
And Mr. McLaughlin, you'll have the 5 minutes of rebuttal, okay, of course. You're welcome. And when counsel for respondent, you may proceed. And if you would first identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. Consent has to be freely given. It has to be words or actions that indicate consent. There's nothing like that here. If you look at appellant's brief on page 4, the argument is that when he was massaging her shoulders, neck, and collarbone area, and she says, "That feels good," he reasonably construed that as being consent to touch her breasts. And that's absurd. I mean, a massage therapist must hear "that feels good" all the time. That doesn't mean I'm giving you permission to touch me sexually. There's not a rational basis for concluding here that he thought that was consent. He might have hoped he had consent. He might have presumed consent, but consent has to be affirmatively and freely given, and he didn't have that here. What appellant's asking you to do here is to add a knowledge element to the criminal sexual conduct statute that he was convicted under. But the legislature didn't create a knowledge element here, and it knows how to do that. It's created a knowledge element when you have an impaired victim, for example. Now, sometimes it's true you have to read a knowledge element in to avoid strict liability. And that really seems to be appellant's argument here. But that's not a problem in this case because you had to have intentional sexual contact. Accidental contact is not enough. It has, the contact has to be intentional and it has to be sexual.
Mr. Raggetts?
Yes.
We were asking Mr. McLaughlin, the judges were, with regard to intent. And normally intent in a scenario might be circumstantial. My question to you is that my understanding from the record is he admitted the intent was sexual. It was within sexual contact was with sexual intent. Now, given that and given the testimony of the victim that she had not given consent, my question to you is, would this not be a direct evidence case, both with regard to intent and consent, and we defer to the jury?
It is, Your Honor, and I make that point in my brief, and then I make the fallback argument that even if you go with circumstantial evidence standard, we still win because there's no rational basis. But you're right, the victim directly said, I didn't consent to this. I was horrified by this. And we have to assume the jury believed her because the jury convicted. What if, so it's a direct evidence case, and under the direct evidence, there is no evidence of consent.
What if, Mr. Raggetts, what if she had said yes? What if he had made the inquiry and she said yes, and but she really meant no? It really, as a matter of fact, was not consensual. She did not consent, even though she gave some words of consent. Wouldn't we then be talking about what's in his head and whether what he believed was reasonable? And don't we then get into the subjective element as not only to the actions, but also to the consent?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if you look at the statute just says there has to be sexual contact during massage and it has to be non-consensual. So whether it's non-consensual is a fact question. And if she said yes, then the only fact question, I guess, for the jury would be, was it clear to him that that yes was accompanied by a head shake or something else or a language barrier or some reason that the yes was actually no and he should have known that? But if she did something that actually created consent, then he's not guilty.
What if she said nothing? What if she said nothing? There was only nonverbal communication the entire time. You can have a nonverbal, consensual sexual relationship or sexual contact.
That's true, Your Honor. And if she had nodded her head, then that would have been a factual question for the jury whether that was reasonably construed as consent.
Well, when I say nonverbal, let's say non-gestures as well. I mean, you could have very subtle, I don't know how to put it, but I mean, if he touched her and she said nothing, but in her heart, she may be consenting, she may not be consenting. You would agree, I assume, that sometimes there's no gestures at all, that there's movement and no resistance and implied consent without any words being spoken or gestures being made. I'm just trying to get a sense of how far you're taking this idea that what goes on in the defendant's head subjectively is not necessary for a conviction.
Well, Your Honor, I'm relying here on the definition of consent that's set out in the jigs and the jury was given, which says consent means words or overt acts by a person indicating a freely given present agreement, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't just presume or assume consent. If you do, you're taking a risk that it isn't there. That's why we're not talking about strict liability here, because you have to intentionally engage in the sexual contact, and you're on notice that unless you get express consent beforehand, you might be committing a crime. That's a risk you're taking, just like in the Wenthe case. The Wenthe case is very persuasive here, because Father Wenthe had sex with a parishioner. That is not illegal. It is only illegal because he did it when she was seeking spiritual counsel. But we didn't have to prove that he knew she was seeking spiritual counsel. He took that risk. And the same thing is true here. Appellant, when he engaged in sexual contact, was taking the risk that he was guilty of a crime unless he got express consent beforehand. And there's no dispute that he didn't, or at least under the victim's version.
Just so we're clear, you keep saying express consent, which is not a term that's actually in the statute itself.
Well, I'm using express as a shorthand for words or overt acts. I agree that overt acts can be, I would include that in express. Like nodding is an expression of yes, even though it's nonverbal. I'm sure there could be other acts, but the definition is quite clear. It can't be something you just presume or hope for. If someone smiles at you on the bus, you can't say, well, I presume she was consenting, so there then I grabbed her. I mean, that's not enough. You're taking a risk of non-consent if you do that. And that's why we're not dealing with a strict liability situation here, just like in Wenthe. Appellants relied very heavily in his reply brief and principal brief on the Dorn case. But Dorn cites Wenthe, and Dorn doesn't involve criminal sexual contact, where the contact or the penetration has to be intentional. And that's how you get beyond strict liability. Again, appellant was on notice here through the law that he had to get consent. Words or actions really give an indicating consent before he could engage in this sexual contact. And under the victim's version, which the jury believed, he didn't do that.
Mr. Agates, I noticed it was not mentioned in your brief, nor in appellant's counsel's brief either, the fact that the judge neglected to include the complete definition of sexual contact to include sexual or aggressive intent. My question to you is, would you agree that was clear error? And if so, how should we dispose of the matter based on that absence?
Well, Your Honor, appellant has never argued that was an error in the jury instruction. So appellant's waived any such argument. There certainly wouldn't be any prejudice here if there was such an error, because the dispute here was between two radically different versions of events. Either the jury believed appellant, who said she pulled down the towel, she nodded four times. Appellant's defense was, She created this. She brought it on. She wanted it, versus the victim's version, which is this just happened out of the blue. I had no idea. And I think maybe most importantly here is appellant admitted he touched her with sexual intent. If that had been a dispute here, if he had said, no, I was just grazed her while I was reaching for something else, then that might be a problem if there was that error in the jury instruction here. But appellant has never disputed that he touched her with sexual and aggressive intent. His claim just was, well, I did that because she basically told me to. And that is that's a theory the jury obviously rejected.
And that's the point you made earlier, that's the reason you also believe it's a direct evidence case, even as to intent, because of his admission.
Right, because of what she said and because of what he admitted. He never disputed that he did this intentionally. Now, his argument is, well, I intentionally touched her, but I didn't intentionally non-consensually touch her. But that's essentially a knowledge requirement. And under an argument like that, for example, you'd always have to have mistake of age as a defense, because a 30-year-old defendant who slept with a 14-year-old who he thought was 16 could say, well, yeah, I intentionally slept with a 14-year-old, but I intended to sleep with a 16-year-old. Therefore, I'm not guilty. But that's not the way it works. That would be a knowledge requirement, and there's no knowledge requirement in this statute. There's no mistake of age defense if you're 30 and she was 14. We just have to prove that an intentional action occurred and that it violates the law. And I think Wenthe makes that clear. Dorn doesn't go against that. And in fact, Wenthe also talks about a gun case, Nadeekum, where possession of a gun was only illegal without a permit if you were on public property. But in Wenthe, the court explained that in Nadeekum, the court said, you don't have to prove that the defendant knew he was on public property, even though that's the only thing that made it a crime. So it's simply not the case, as appellant seems to suggest from Dorn, that you always have to prove the defendant knew the facts that made the action criminal. Appellant is not being found strictly liable here because we have to prove, and he admitted that he intentionally engaged in sexual contact. And under the facts as accepted by the jury, the victim did not consent. So the jury instruction here is A, fine, because there's no knowledge requirement in the statute. But B, it's certainly not plain error because there's no case law that says what appellant's asking this court to say, that you have to prove subjective intent or knowledge in a situation like this. And then the other problem with appellant's jury instruction argument is that he can't meet his burden of proving prejudice because there's no rational basis for him to have thought he had consent here, and there's no rational basis for the jury to have thought this was just a big misunderstanding when his defense was she wanted it, she asked for it, and her defense was I didn't do anything like that. There was never a presentation to the jury of a misunderstanding defense, and there's no basis to, there's no facts to support a misunderstanding defense.
Mr. Reagans?
Yes, Judge Reyes.
Yes. So bottom line here, is this really just an issue of consent? It's not an issue of sexual intent. It's not an issue of whether or not he touched her. It's not an issue of knowledge. Is this really just an issue of consent? Is that what your argument is?
I think so, Your Honor. Yes, that was the argument for the jury, that it all came down to credibility. Did she consent or didn't she? Now, I think appellant is trying to get beyond that by arguing even if she didn't consent, you still had to have knowledge of her lack of a consent. That's really what his intent argument goes to. He had to know she didn't consent to prove that he intended non-consensual sexual contact. And that's where I'm saying he's wrong about the law, because there isn't any knowledge requirement in the statute. You don't need it to avoid strict liability. This case is just like Wenthe. We don't have to prove that the defendant knew the facts that made the sexual action criminal. And so if you put that reading, if you put his reading of the law aside, that's yes, then this does just come down to
again
rational basis.
If I could, but you would have to prove, I would assume, if there, well, you're saying that you don't have to prove that he knows that she doesn't give consent, but you would agree that if the facts would have suggested consent, you would, and it was ambiguous, you would have to get into what was reasonable and what he understood and what a reasonable person would understand and what, in fact, he understood.
Well, I think it's not understanding. It's just whether or not there was consent, and that would be a factual question. Was, you know, and we have the burden of proof here, so we'd have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that she didn't consent if it was ambiguous whether she did or didn't. And that's where the key thing here is that she didn't say anything that could be in any way reasonably construed as giving consent. I mean, his only argument there is she said it feels good when he was massaging her shoulders.
Well, by the way, was she ever expressly asked the questions that I know she didn't testify that there was an inquiry, and she didn't testify that she nodded her head, but he testified that she lowered the towel down, exposing her breasts above her nipples, and that she that he asked the question about lowering his hands, and that she nodded approvingly. Did she ever affirmatively testify that these things were not so, or is it just that those things were not part of her testimony at all, one way or the other?
Your Honor, I believe that she denied those things happened, but I don't have those facts in front of me. I know that she adamantly said, I did not consent. I did not say anything to indicate consent. She certainly didn't say anything about pulling the towel down. She basically said the massage was going along perfectly normally, and it was fine up until the very end when all of a sudden he grabbed her breasts. So she didn't indicate that she did anything that would reasonably lead someone to conclude there was consent, and that's the gist of the argument here. And since I have 4 seconds left, I will simply ask that you affirm unless you have additional questions.
Very well, thank you, counsel. And Mr. McLaughlin, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal. One question I did want you to respond to, Mr. McLaughlin, about the jury instruction missing the sexual or aggressive intent. Is it true? I assume, number one, you would agree that was there, but is the reason it's not raised by your in your brief because he does admit in his testimony it was with sexual intent, so it would clearly be would not affect him substantively.
We would concede that, and the plain error cases have looked at the likelihood of conviction if the jury had been instructed on the element, and we feel that based on his admission, the jury would have found that element had it been instructed.
And a follow-up question: did trial counsel offer a specific jury instruction? I assume not, because that's why we're in a clear error. And assuming not, what instruction would you propose that should have been given by the judge regarding your interpretation of the mens rea intent?
The instruction we would propose is to be guilty of this offense, the defendant must intend to engage in the prohibited conduct. The prohibited conduct under the statute is non-consensual sexual contact. So to convict, you need the state needs to prove that the defendant intended to engage in non-consensual sexual contact. And the basis for that instruction really, as respondent said, comes from Dorn, as the case that dealt with specifically with general intent crimes. And that's really the framework that we try to argue under on this case. We feel like this statute should be governed under. It's not really as much a knowledge requirement as respondent says. It's more how appellate courts have dealt with general intent crimes and what's required for general intent crimes. And for general intent crimes, in Dorn, the Supreme Court said that the defendant must intend the prohibited act, the actus reus. In Dorn, that prohibited act, the court interpreted to be non-consensual touching or non-consensual force. Under this statute, the prohibited act is non-consensual sexual touching. And just as Dorn held that the defendant must intend to engage in non-consensual force, it's our position that applying Dorn here, that means that the defendant must intend to engage in non-consensual sexual touching. I went a little astray from your question, but I just want to develop that a little bit. And the respondent repeatedly cited to Wenthe, and we distinguish that on the ground that Wenthe involved an attendant circumstance. And in the Supreme Court's cases in Nidicum and it's also the discussion in Wenthe, it distinguishes between the conduct that the defendant engages in, which is the actus reus, and the attendant circumstances. The clergy statute, that's an attendant circumstance that makes the conduct illegal. It's not what the defendant does. The fact that it's a spiritual meeting is not something the defendant does. That's different than the massage subdivision, which addresses the defendant's behavior of non-consensual sexual contact. And because it addresses that criminal behavior, it's our view that it falls under Dorn, under the requirement that the defendant needs to intend to engage in that criminal behavior. And that's part of what the state must prove to establish guilt. So I think a lot of the disagreement between the parties is sort of on whether it's an objective test for consent or a subjective test, as we argue. We concede that if this court does view consent objectively, it needs to affirm the conviction. Everything we argue depends on this notion that the defendant must intend to engage in non-consensual sexual contact. In response to concern about whether this would be plain error, our position is under Dorn, under that requirement for general intent crimes, of which criminal sexual conduct is one. It's well established under Dorn that the party must intend to engage in that prohibited conduct. The statute expressly states what that prohibited conduct is as non-consensual sexual contact. So it was clear law that the state had to prove he intended to engage in that conduct. And as far as whether it had a substantial effect on the jury verdict, the jury was never presented with the question of whether the evidence proved that the defendant subjectively intended to engage in non-consensual contact. We cite evidence that we believe could support a conclusion that he did not engage in that contact, and that even looking at the complainant's testimony, there were circumstances in her testimony that are inconsistent with him having that intent. So we feel that this plain error did affect substantial rights in this case. And just getting very briefly to some concerns Judge Ross raised.
Let me jump in with one quick question before your timer's on. Would you agree that if we read the record and find no facts from which a reasonable juror could infer that your client believed he had consent before the touching of the breasts, that we wouldn't need to get, that there would be no prejudice to your client, even if the court was wrong in its understanding of the law?
I'd agree on the sufficiency argument. That would support rejecting our sufficiency argument if the court made that finding. Because if there's no reasonable juror could find that he had that intent, then our sufficiency argument would need to fail. I think the jury instruction argument is a little bit different, because for that, the court can also consider his testimony. and ask if the jury looked at all of the legal elements that we feel that the defense says are required with and looked at his testimony under that rubric, is there a possibility that it would have acquitted him? And I think that's a little bit different question. We feel that even if this court concludes that the victim's statements don't support a reasonable view that he had the subjective intent, it still should remand for a new trial because his testimony at least could have led the jury to that conclusion if the jury had been instructed on the elements correctly.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. Right. We appreciate your briefing and your answers to our questions today and your comments. We will take the matter under advisement, issue an order. You all right, each have a good day.